Page story in the Newport newspaper, Gombrich cast deciding vote on.
I will open the subcommittee on natural resources for March 11th, 2015. The item we have on the agenda is a hearing on HB 5037. Public testimony will be tomorrow. Ms. Gilbert, is there anything before we bring the agency back up?
Mr. Chair, there is not. They can continue. I believe they are on slide 15 of the slide deck.
Okay. And so bring up whoever you need to bring up, and we will get started.
Good morning, Chair Devlin, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Abrams, and I'm the director of the Department of State Lands. I did want to indicate that I took the questions that we weren't able to answer fully yesterday back to the office, and I do have responses for those. I have them written down, or I can just go through them orally quickly if you would all like. And then I also brought back, because there was a fair amount of interest yesterday just on the history of the Common School Fund, so I brought back a set of citations, literature citations that might be helpful for folks, and I have a copy for each of you of that as well.
The answers to the questions, have you sent them to us already?
I have not sent them to you. I just brought a hard copy with me. I just finished them a few minutes ago.
Why don't you send them to us first, and then we'll come back to them tomorrow.
Okay.
And see if we can get through the presentation today.
Okay. I'll try to be a little bit quicker. So we left off with our hero mired in goal 3 of our strategic plan, which is our goal to administer the unclaimed property and estates laws while safeguarding assets within the Common School Fund. This is the program in our department that manages the unclaimed property that we hold in perpetuity for the rightful owners, as well as administering estates for people who die without a will and without a known heir. We hold the resources from those estates for 10 years after administering the estate, and working with finders to try and find the heirs for those estates. If no one is found in 10 years, those monies transfer or escheat to the Common School Fund as well. And that, as you'll remember, is part of the responsibilities that we got at statehood. I want to make sure that you understand that the unclaimed property is not a small portion of the Common School Fund. So when we think about the $50 million that we're able to distribute annually, more or less at this point in time, a large percentage of that is dependent on having the unclaimed property in the Common School Fund while we hold it in trust for the owners, because we have about $500 million now in unclaimed property. So it's a substantial program.
Excuse me, I had one question, actually. If the property escheats to the state after 10 years, does the state have any future liability then, should someone come in after that period and claim that they had a right to the property?
Chair Devlin, for the unclaimed property, it does not escheat, and that property is held in perpetuity for the rightful owners. It's the estates that we administer that do escheat, and my understanding is that once they have escheated, they are part of the state's funds and no longer available for the heirs should they be found.
Okay.
Is that correct? So looking at the numbers for this program in fiscal year 2014, you can see we had a record almost $64 million that were reported to us at the end of the year. This is a really big workload that comes in towards the end of the year, and we were really happy we were able to process these quickly and record the amounts because of some of the electronic improvements that we've done in our system, which I'll talk about later. We also paid out in 2014 over $23 million. To rightful owners who came forward and laid their claims, and there were a little over 13,000 of those claimants. For the estates program, we administered 284 estates, and during fiscal year 2014, we had just a little under $7 million that was pending permanent escheat to the Common School Fund in that program. So if there are no questions about that program, I'm going to move on to the Common School Fund and our administration of that. The goal, this is goal four of our strategic plan, and the goal here is to monitor investments and sustain distributions to our schools. I've laid out some of the distributions that you can see from 2008 to 2014. You can see we've, with the change in the 2009 in the distribution policy, we've really been able to maintain a fairly steady amount of money each year that's being distributed to the schools. I'll remind you that the current policy is 4% of the three-year rolling average of the value of the fund, the invested fund. We do on occasion have a request to increase that distribution, and we have up until now been able to make that without having any kind of permanent impact to the fund. But we have had clear warnings, I guess you'd say, from the Oregon Investment Council investors who work with us that if we distribute more than about 4% continuously, then we risk decreasing the corpus of the fund and therefore future distributions. We do have performance targets that we set for the investment portfolio, and the investors have been able to beat those targets for the last three-year period with an average annual earning of 13.25%. So we feel like that's a really good return on our investment for the Common School Fund, and it's brought the market value of the Common School Fund up to about $1.4 billion. I think this is important because it shows that we are really attaining this goal in the sense that we're administering the Common School Fund, still doing the operations that have been assigned to us both by the Constitution and the legislature, and in fact still earning more money than we're spending. We do have a couple of option packages that are related to this goal. The first one is for the internal audit controls and for accounting. This, if you'll remember, there were two audits, one in 2013 that I mentioned, which you can find in your large budget binder. And in that, this is an external audit that's done by an external auditor. In that audit, there was a comment on a lack of internal controls and a request to address that issue. So we worked through the hiring of a limited duration position, an accountant for, in order to address those internal controls. It worked very well. And in 2014, when we did our external audit, we had a clean audit. And so we believe there's a value in continuing the work of this accountant for, and we'd like to make that position permanent, and this option package would do that, as well as provide us some funds for contracting for internal audit functions that are not really cost efficient to have in terms of personnel, FTE on the books, but we do need to do because of the size of the fund. The second option package has to do with our operations that support the Common School Fund. It's a little bit of a hodgepodge, but the big issue here is replacement of a couple of servers that are over 10 years old. And these support all the electronic functions that really help us monitor effectively the ins and outs of the Common School Fund and all of the different threads that we run in terms of our constitutional, statutory, revenues and expenditures. And so we believe it's really important to have up-to-date servers for that work. It also includes some communications equipment that would allow field staff to be more efficient in their work, therefore decreasing the operations cost to the Common School Fund, allowing them to collect field data directly in the field rather than having to bring it back and re-enter it once they come back to the office. And finally, it ensures safety both by increasing the ability to communicate with staff in the field, but also by replacing a 1997 Ford vehicle that we have that's not very energy efficient and has a lot of maintenance issues at this time. It's a big truck that we use to get around in some of the remote areas in southeastern Oregon, and we'd like to be able to replace that with something that has less maintenance and has a little bit better fuel efficiency.
Excuse me, we have a question. Senator Hanson.
I was going to wait till you're through with goal four. Are you through?
I am through with goal four. Thank you.
Thank you, Co-Chair. A question I have on the on goal, the maximizing the return, and I want to go back to the Elliott for just a moment. I understand, it's my understanding that it actually is a liability right now. It's costing, $3 million?
Chair Devlin, Senator Hansel, it cost us $3 million in 2013. We actually made just a little bit over the operating expenses in 2014. We're a little concerned we'll be below the red line in 2015, however.
But in 2014, you had a sale, right?
We had a sale.
And that would account for the being a little, making a little bit of money.
Senator Devlin, Senator Hansel, actually, there, I believe that we made money on the operations.
Yes.
No. Sorry, you are correct, it appears, that the sale of those parcels were actually what bumped us over the mark.
What did the, if I may ask, what were the sales that you, I believe you sold 2,800 acres and three parcels, right? What kind of return did we get on that?
Senator Devlin, Senator Hansel, let me ask Assistant Director Paul to come up and answer that question.
Please proceed.
Good morning. I'm Jim Paul, Assistant Director of the Department of State Lands. I oversee the Common School Fund program. Senator Devlin, Senator Hansel, we sold three parcels that totaled about 1,400 acres in the Elliott, and the total sale price for those parcels were, I believe, $4.5 million, and we netted about $4.2 million after our marketing costs for the transaction costs.
The question I have, if the Common School Fund is, you know, it's on the Elliott, it was to maximize the return for the Common School Fund. On slide four, or the goal four that you have, you have a return of 13.25% and a portfolio of $1.4 billion. Has it been looked at or concerned, or why wouldn't we, at the kind of prices you got on 1,400 acres, sell it and put it into the fund that's getting 13.25% back to our schools? I mean, that's billions of dollars. Rather than going limping along year by year and losing money on an asset that could be sold and the returns put in and making 13.25 and helping our schools.
Chair Devlin, Senator Hansel, that's a very good question and one that we ask ourselves as well as have other people pose to us. There's a couple of issues that need to be considered, and all of this discussion is part of the project that we have going on right now in terms of trying to evaluate the future for the Elliott. And one of the options, in fact, is to change ownership, which means buying out the Common School Fund and then reinvesting those funds in some way, which at this point in time seems like the market is a good option. But I do want to draw your attention to the fact that there is some inherent value in that land. And so what the land board has to consider is the long term as well as the short term. And so there is an argument that says there's a potential in the future that the lands would be making money either through renewed timber harvest, for instance, if the endangered species were delisted, or we came to an agreement with the Federal Services that was legally defensible around managing the timber harvest, or through some newer markets, the markets that really are not very developed at this point in time, carbon markets, ecosystem service markets. So what we are doing is evaluating sort of the possibility of those future values against the value of selling the forest to a third party, be it another state agency or a private party, and investing those funds in the Common School Fund itself. So we are looking at that question.
Wonderful. Yeah. I thought you said earlier in your presentation yesterday that the option for sale was off the table.
Chair Devlin, Senator Hansel, right now, for this period of time, while we're considering until we get back to the land board in June, what we are looking at is three options, one of which is the transfer of ownership. What the land board requested was that we look at some form of transfer of ownership that would not just be a public auction. So we're trying to investigate a number of ways. And primarily that was because of a concern expressed by a number of people for the change in status of the forest if it moved to the private industry, where people might not have access to the forest. There's been an increase down in that area of people being charged for hunting and fishing access, for instance. And so local community was very concerned about maintaining access to the forest. There was an interest in having some of the values, the conservation values, protected over the long term. So there was an interest expressed by pretty much across the board to have some portion of the forest or some part of the partnership that might own the forest in public hands to assure those public values.
One more follow-up.
Yeah.
That may all be well, but the whole reason the Elliott exists legally and is in the DSL is the trustee is for the Common School Fund. It's not for access. It's not for hunting and fishing. It was to provide income for the schools, and I think that's to have a $1.4 billion investment portfolio that's returning 13.25%, and we're losing money now on the current asset. It's not providing anything. It seems to me that the mission and the trusteeship that DSL has on that is shifting or something. But I appreciate the
Chair Devlin, Senator Hansel, I don't disagree with you on the importance of evaluating whether or not we should dispose of the asset, and it is one of the things that we're working through in this process.
Mr. Chair, if I could follow up. Yeah, I think it's a good idea for the board to really look at all options thoroughly. And we don't want to get into a situation where we're selling, if we are going to make sales, to do it at a time where the value is really low because of the fear of, that it's not going to be a worthwhile investment, so the buyer is not going to pay very much. I don't know, how were the sales? Were they those that you experimented with? Did you get a lot of money for them? I guess that's one question. And the second that I've been wondering is, will you be watching what happens with those lands that you've sold, both in terms of how they're used and whether or not the buyers are getting value out of that investment?
Chair Devlin, Senator Denbrough, I'll answer your second question first. We believe that having sold those lands, it's sort of like selling your house. You put a lot of love and effort and interest in it, but once you've sold it, you've sold it. And so we are not engaging in what's happening on those lands. We definitely hear about it because there are people who are interested who tell us, but we don't believe that that's a responsibility of the departments. In terms of the value, I'm going to ask Assistant Director Paul to speak directly to the actual value, but I do want to point out there's a lot of conversation about the fact that we sold these lands potentially at a basement price, and we're selling at the wrong time of the market. The reality is, since the beginning of the 1990s, the value of this forest has declined. As we've gone through all of the investigations with the Endangered Species Act, that decline is not likely in the near future to turn around. What we can't say is what will happen over the long term, and that's where we really need to balance and look at the risks versus the potential benefits of disposing of this asset and investing in another asset. And Assistant Director Paul
can I ask the Assistant Director also to clarify when he makes this response? Presuming that since the Elliott is an asset of the Common School Fund, that you're somehow showing it on your books as what the current value is, can you give us that? And the fact that you've sold a certain number of acres, which might or may or may not be acres that are impacted by endangered species, or maybe selective acres that someone has a particular desire to have does not mean necessarily that the value of the entire parcel would be the same as the value of the small portion of it. But what is the Elliott valued at right now? Or do we know that? And then please go on to the rest of the question being asked by the director. So.
Sure. Chair Devlin, Senator Dembrow. To get to that question specifically, we recently went through some very thorough work and evaluation with a consultant through the course of the project we underwent over the last 9 months, and we continue to estimate a value for the Elliott. Our best estimate currently of the forest, it's a broad range between $280 up to over $400 million, but the midpoint of that range is about $360 million. And that evaluation was done taking into account current legal constraints due to federal and state environmental laws and any other zoning and other constraints on the lands relative to other forest lands in the state. These parcels that we sold, we actually very deliberately selected using some specific criteria, one of which was we wanted to have a range of stand ages and types on these parcels. We didn't want them to be all younger or all older. We wanted to try to have these as much as 1,400 acres can represent the 84,000 acres of the Elliott. We wanted to try and have them be representative of the range of conditions on the Elliott. Having said that, as you point out, Chair Devlin, it is still very difficult, problematic to extrapolate the value from these specific parcels being only 3% of the land base. But they do give us some data point to look at. We, when these were appraised, our instructions were, as with our instructions for any parcels go up for appraisal and potential sale, for the appraiser to apply their appraiser standards and practices around any constraints, legal constraints on management of any type of land. So they looked at the Endangered Species Act, state environmental constraints, and came up with a value dependent on their evaluation of those constraints. From that, we came up with the minimum bid values that we offered that went up as part of the auction. Two of the three parcels received those just above those minimum bids. One of the parcels received a bid that was three times the minimum bid. You know, that's what happens in land sale auctions. You never know, you know, what your bidders are going to be and how important that parcel might be to them. So we can't explain exactly why. But it does show you how difficult it is to predict, I think, the actual value of these lands depending on a potential purchasers, their risks, their needs, and how they are evaluating a piece of property.
Yes. How many bidders did you have on the parcels?
We had a total of five. And I'd have to go back and look. On one or two of them, we only had one bid. Mm-hmm. Two of them, we only had one bid. And the third one, we had three bids.
Just following up on my earlier question about keeping an eye on what happens to these lands, I understand the desire to move on, but I think there would be value in the agency looking at that, seeing, because there are people who are questioning those sales, and for various reasons, but also if you are looking at future sales to see if these if there is timber production that actually is able to be done, that'll have an impact, I'm sure, on the future viability of the forest as a whole.
Chair Devlin, Senator Dembrow, I didn't mean to indicate that we weren't watching it, but we don't believe that it's what happens is our responsibility. We definitely are aware, as I said, there's a lot of people who are interested, both the purchasers as well as some of the other people engaged in this conversation. And so we definitely hear how things are going. We have been in court and just recently had a positive decision from a state circuit court judge on our ability to sell one of the sales that was challenged in court. I think the main piece that I'd like to leave with all of you is a recognition on the department's part, on the land board's part, of the untenable situation of continuing to lose money on the Elliott. And what the board has tried to do is figure out if there is enough of a value permanent value in the forest, to maintain the forest, even if we get less than what we would normally get off of the forest. What we've been trying to do is continue to maximize our revenues, and that is really the piece that's been most difficult for us. If we could instead get a lower return on asset value each year, but maintain the permanent value of the land, that's sort of the fundamental question on whether or not the land board sees fit to maintain the ownership of the Elliott, or to transfer that asset to somebody else and use the funds that are received for the asset to invest as they see fit. The real challenge, of course, is that the Elliott is a fairly unique forest down on the south coast, and people are very interested in what happens to it. And so there's been a considerable amount of debate and discussion, and that's why we're taking our time. We definitely are aware that whatever step the land board makes, there's a potential for a lawsuit. And so we would just want to be very clear on our evaluation of all the options before we step into what is almost certainly to be challenged.
Chair
Douglas. Okay. Yes. Representative Rachel.
And so let me get you back to the presentation. and ask you about the policy option package 102 and 103. The first question is, both of those are other funds, and I wanted to know what portion of those other funds are coming out of the Common School Fund to pay for the replacing and upgrading of equipment, and then what portion of the internal controls and accounting are coming from the Common School Fund.
Chair Devlin, Representative Rayfield, all of the other funds come from the Common School Fund.
Okay. And then the one question that I know you had told me this a while back, the return on the Common School Fund, I think you were saying it was around 7%, and then I was forgotten how much of the 7% gets returned to the schools and how much is allocated towards administrative costs.
So, Chair Devlin, Representative Rayfield, it's sort of a complicated scenario, and we do have, we used to always show our famous lake diagram that shows how funds flow into and then are used or distributed from the fund. And I'll try to do it justice in a few brief words, and if I get mixed up, I'll have my assistant director for business operations come up and set me straight. So when we manage our constitutional lands, the revenues from those go into the Common School Fund, and then the operating expenses for that management comes out of the Common School Fund. With our statutory lands and our statutory authorities, we collect the revenues, we pay the operations, and then whatever is left over, we put into the Common School Fund. The distribution is based not on how much comes in every year, because that varies and has varied substantially over the decades. And so what we have, what the land board has chosen to do over the last few years is instead set the distribution based on the rolling average of the 3-year market value of the fund, and that's set at 4%. And I hope that answers your question.
And just a quick follow-up. The administrative costs come out of what's going into the Common School Fund. Okay. Just to make sure I understand.
Chair Devlin, properly. Representative Rayfield, in the most basic of senses, and my assistant director wants to make sure the story is clear.
I'm sorry. For the record, Cindy Wickham, Assistant Director of Money. actually, the constitutional expenses, or the expenses that we have on our constitutional properties, come out of the earnings from the Common School Fund, not from the corpus. The statutory revenues, expenses are directly deducted from those revenues, and then the remainder is put into the fund. So the earnings from the fund are pretty much what fund our expenses.
Okay.
As well as the distributions.
And what percentage of the earnings go towards the administrative costs?
Chair Devlin, Representative Rayfield, I have to go back and pencil that out. I don't have that off the top of my head.
Okay. What I was curious is, by adding an additional position, what does that do to the percentage of administrative costs that are affecting the earnings?
Chair Devlin, Representative Rayfield will work on that and bring back an answer for that tomorrow.
You may want to clarify, though, too, is that, and I think the co-chair probably would want that clarification, that since your earnings vary significantly year to year, more what maybe what they've been in recent years and what they've been over time, because, I mean, they can have a year when they're actually losing money, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, 2008 was not particularly good for anyone.
No. That's correct, Chair Devlin. So we'll come, Chair Devlin, Representative Rayfield, we'll come back with a first stab at it, and if you're not satisfied and want a little bit more information, we'll be happy to go back and get that as well.
Perfect. Thank you.
So I'll move on to Goal 5, and this is our goal around working with our external partners as well as working effectively internally as well. So our Goal 5 is to deliver efficient professional service to our customers through improved communications, employee training, and administrative systems. And we've really, this has been a really important goal for both myself and for my two immediate predecessors. It was recognized, I think, as we started to get more and more responsibilities, that there really was a need to work very closely with people on the ground as partners rather than as sort of a regulated community or a lessee relationship, because those people are the people that do the work on the ground. And so we've really taken this very seriously. We have customer service surveys that we do biennially, and we have seen consistent improvements since we started those surveys in 2007. In 2007, if you looked at the excellent and good ratings combined, we had about 72% in that category of the responses. And in 2014, we had almost 85% in the good and excellent category. So we believe we're making progress. We recognize that this is difficult to do with a regulatory agency, because a lot of people don't like to be regulated. But we believe that if we approach the regulation as well as the resource protection in the right framework and working with people in a positive way, that we should be able to find our customer and service ratings going up. We've implemented a number of approaches on trying to get the customer service to keep those improvements going. We've really increased our paperless work, so we do a lot of electronic processing of materials, both from the from our external partners as well as from internally, in terms of our normal administrative paperwork, which is now electron work instead of paperwork. We've really expanded our electronic filing and records retention, and that helps keep our costs down in terms just of storage, because of the number of issues that we're involved with, we tend to have a large volume of paperwork, and by expanding into electronic filing, we're able to cut down on our storage costs. We've also developed a lot of web-based tools, particularly in the unclaimed property arena, but also in our permitting arena, to help people access us more easily, as everybody's getting more and more accustomed to accessing information on the web. They can now do that for the department. And we also, of course, I mentioned at the very beginning yesterday, we went through a reorganization last year in October that reorganized particularly our aquatic resources management work geographically, so that we now have teams of staff that work in a single geographic area, and that really helps to build relationships with the customers that are out in those areas. So if there are no questions, I'm just cognizant of the time here, so I'm going to move as quickly as possible. I'll move on to Goal 6, which is the work that we do for the state as the partner in the federal-state partnership for the South Slough National Estuarine Research Reserve. And our goal there is just to serve as a state partner, providing leadership and administrative oversight. So the South Slough, if you'll recall, was a part of the Coastal Zone Management Act back in the early 1970s, and Oregon was the first state to sign up to be part of the network of estuarine research reserves that was developed under that program. There are now 28 around the nation. The program provides for education, research, and stewardship in estuarine environments around the United States. And for us, we really focus on the South Slough, but we also provide education and research that and information sharing that applies along the entire coast of Oregon, and in fact, up into Washington and down into California, as we work with some of the neighboring reserves as well. There are four basic components at the South Slough: research and monitoring. We have a monitoring, water quality monitoring network that is a little over 40 years old, and so it's a very rare information set that is hard to find in other parts of the nation, and particularly in the state of Oregon. So it has a great deal of value for looking at things like sea level rise, ocean acidification, issues like that that are long-term in nature. We do education, outreach, and interpretive services. So we have an interpretive center that is houses some displays and exhibits that people can where people can learn about the estuaries. It includes trails that go down through, and you can walk and see some of the environment that is in the South Slough. We do stewardship and resource management. This has been important in latter years because of the way the reserve is laid out up the watershed. We do have some areas that have upland forest environments, and including some of the Port Orford cedar, which is really important to that area economically and has suffered from some disease issues in the last decade or so. And so we've been working on that and trying to help work with Oregon State University to address that issue. And then we just have straight-on recreation down at the South Slough. It's a beautiful place to go kayaking, hiking, collecting mushrooms, bird watching. If you look at the programs that are offered, there are summer camps, there are public workshops, interpretive programs, as I said, that talk about specific topics, and educational events. This includes a lot of work with teachers, secondary and primary school teachers, to help them find tools to incorporate science more effectively into their programs. We do have collaborative partnerships with the watershed groups down in the area, and we really are considered on the West Coast to be one of the leaders in terms of the research that we do, partly because, as I mentioned before, the monitoring network that has enough years on it to really be valuable for some of these long-term issues. If you go to fiscal year 2014 to sort of see how the program plays out, you can see that we have a fair number of education programs. We run 36 training workshops, and those are, as I said, oftentimes with teachers, but sometimes with decision makers. We've had over 7,000 participants in these programs, and in addition to that, we've had almost 4,000 visitors just to the Interpretive Center itself. And we've engaged in just a little under 19 research projects. And many of those projects are done, as I said, in conjunction with either the Oregon State University or the University of Oregon, which has the Oregon Institute for Marine Biology there in Charleston as well. We do have one option package associated with this program, and that's to do a position alignment of the lead workers for the education and research staff. In the reorganization, we established a clear group around education and one around research. We already had a lead worker for status assigned for the research group. The education lead worker does similar duties, and we just want to make sure that that classification is equivalent as well. And so net increase to the budget. We'd be moving supplies and services funds to the personal services just to increase that position to a lead worker status. So that's all of the goals in our strategic plan. I wanted to just indicate that we do measure our progress on these goals, and you can find the annual performance report under tab 10, page 263 in your large binder. We have 17 key performance measures that we track. They cover really all of the specific activities that I've mentioned today. We do have a general summary here of where we are on those key performance measures. We have 61% that are green, 33% that are yellow or red, and 6% that are exceptions. It's been we've definitely had some challenges in all of the key performance measures that have to do with revenue generation, particularly because of some of the issues that we faced in our forestry production, particularly around the Elliott. The key performance measures also include a measure, as I mentioned in Goal 5, of customer satisfaction with the agency as a whole. And but we don't, at the end of the day, because we don't make the direct investment decisions, we don't have a key performance measure around those decisions and their impact on performance.
And I just wanted to quickly have you touch on there. You said there's about 33% that are in the yellow and the red.
Mm-hmm.
If you could just kind of, and it sounds like a majority of those, or maybe even all of them, are because of the management issues with the Elliott. But I was kind of curious if you could walk through. It seems like there might be five or six of those. If you could just walk through those for the panel and kind of just, you know, give us a little background of, you know, why we're not performing, and is there any, you know, plans going forward to change that, or maybe there's some extenuating circumstances of why that is what it is.
Thanks. Chair Rehfeld, I'm asking Assistant Director Wickham to get my big notebook. I'm just looking for a summary report, which I don't see. I think probably the easiest, just from a time framework, is I can put that together for you in a summary format. And if you don't mind, I'm just worried about the time.
Yeah, let's go ahead and get through the presentation.
And I can bring that, but I can bring that back tomorrow.
That'd
to
be fantastic.
Include in the comments that I return to you. And actually, I can send it to you electronically, hopefully before the day's over. Okay?
Perfect.
A valid question. I just didn't think to prepare specifically for it, so I apologize. I did want to talk a little bit about some of the major budget drivers for us as an agency, and some of these will appear in even starker contrast as we talk about the context around this session in a few minutes. Obviously, our big budget driver is to maintain the Common School Fund and to grow it sustainably so that we can have the distributions for the K through 12 schools. We also have the responsibility from our statutory assignments to protect Oregon's waterways, both for the regulatory purpose of regulating and implementing the Removal Fill Act, but also from the perspective of ensuring public uses are assured on our state-owned waterways. We also work, as far as budget drivers, we believe that one of the things that really allows us to be effective and efficient in the use of our budget is to have good outreach so that people understand our programs, and then we have more of a collaborative sense of trying to get the work done as opposed to having to spend a lot of energy pulling people along. So that's one of our budget drivers. And we always look to reduce administrative costs where we can, therefore be able to increase the distributions to the schools. I will point out that that part of our outreach efforts that's been particularly particularly productive in terms of the efficiency of the department and our ability to maintain the Common School Fund has been the outreach work that we've done for the unclaimed property, which has really increased the holder reporting over the last few years. And that's really been entirely up to some training that we've done with holders, as well as outreach directly to them as we've gone through the last few years. I do want to talk a little bit about environmental factors. We're a natural resource agency, and we work with a lot of environmental issues. And so I wanted to walk through some of these really quickly. Obviously, we've spent a good deal of time talking about the Elliott. It's one of the key things that lies in front of us at this point in time. It's not our only threatened and endangered ESA issue. However, we have 625,000 roughly acres of rangelands out in eastern Oregon, and many of those have some habitat for the Great Basin sage grouse. Great Basin sage grouse has not been listed as under the Endangered Species Act, but it is a candidate species. And because of that, we were interested. We tried to learn from our experience with the northern spotted owl and the marbled murrelet. And so we've been working actively with the service, as have a number of counties and private landowners out in eastern Oregon, to set up some criteria for management of those lands that would stay in place even if the bird were to be listed. We're all hoping that the efforts of the state will provide enough certainty to the federal service that they won't list the bird, but if they do, we are getting into place an agreement that would allow us to maintain our current management operations without having a hit from further restrictions if the bird were listed. We look continually at the potential for non-traditional streams of revenue from the environmental side. And there's a lot of discussion about these non-traditional. And when I think about them, I think I mentioned it yesterday, the most mature of these systems, these market systems, is the wetland mitigation banks that we're already engaged in. But there's the carbon market. Many of you have heard about carbon trading and the work, you know, the ability to sell carbon credits. There's been quite a bit of talk and even some marketing around clean water, cleaning waters up using environmental systems. And so we're tracking the development of those markets. At this point in time, really none of them are a significant revenue source for us. And because of the fact that our lands are held in public ownership, many times they're not even available for the markets, because the markets are centered around preventing actions on private lands and not on public lands, with the assumption that public lands are already protected from many of these uses. I want to note that with the return in the economic recovery, we all hope that that continues. One of the not calculated impacts of that is that we get a whole lot more work on removal fill because people are doing more development, and so that has that environmental factor comes into play for us. We talked yesterday quite a bit about the Portland Harbor Superfund site. That's obviously an environmental factor that we're keeping track of. It's a potential big liability for the state, and so we think it's very important to be involved in crafting the solution and making sure that the allocation of responsibility for the contamination is appropriately assigned. We have had some, you know, I just talked about the South Slough Reserve. That's been a really nice program for the state of Oregon. We've been funding it now for about 40 years, and starting point was a good partnership with the federal government. As the federal funds have gotten tighter, we've seen a lot of their support dry up, and so we're still at about 50-50, but it's their funds continue to shrink, and so that's a real challenge for that program. Because of the work that we do, back to some of the conversation we had yesterday about the agricultural development, including the work around the Elliott, some of our regulatory work, we do have legal challenges to our actions, and defending against those is always puts a strain both on regular operations resources as well as our financial resources. And then finally, just like any landowner in eastern Oregon, I guess all over the state this year, we have drought issues for our rangelands. This is particularly important because not only does it put us at a higher risk for fire, which we lost about 70,000 acres in fire last year. But it also, even if we don't have a fire, it restricts the amount of grazing that we can have on our lands and maintain them in a healthy condition. And so it decreases the time that the lessees can have on them, and then decreases our grazing revenues. So we have had some changes around the agency, and I wanted to talk a little bit about that. We reorganized in 2014, and I already explained why we did that and some of the goals. I would say that we have seen already an increase in our ability to do our aquatic resource management in a way that we close some of the gaps around the between the regulatory and the proprietary work, and we've already seen that in just a short period of time we've been working in our new organizational structure. We have a statutory commitment to House Bill 4131 to increase our staff to management ratios to 11 to 1. We are at 9 to 1 and therefore ahead of schedule for our trajectory, but we're continuing to work to get to that 11 to 1. We did refocus our real estate asset management plan in 2012. We anticipate with some of the lessons that we're learning, both from the Elliott as well as with the East Side rangelands, that we'll be looking, and some of our investments in industrial, commercial, and residential properties, that we'll be needing to refocus that again probably in another couple of years. We continue to try and get the lands that are still owed us from the statehood, from the Bureau of Land Management. We still have about 1,500 acres out that are owed to us in lieu of the lands that they couldn't give us because they had been previously claimed. We're working through, obviously, the alternatives project, and depending on the outcome of that project, that could be a major shift in how the department focuses its attention. Forestry and forestry revenues has been a big part of the department, and if we decided that that wasn't where we were had our best assets, that could be a major shift for the department. And then, of course, as I've mentioned several times, we've improved our claim reporting system for unclaimed property, which has really resulted in those increases in dollars to the unclaimed property program. We have had, we continue to try and contain costs. We are very cognizant of the fact that our operating costs come from the Common School Fund, and we want to make sure that they're contained as much as possible. We use new technologies. I think we've been really on the forefront, particularly internally, of processing paper electronically as opposed to passing pieces of paper around that have to get printed and then copied and then filed and then stored. And so that's been a real advantage. And it's allowed us to increase some of the work that we do without having to add new staff. We've implemented a whole lot of electronic communications. We no longer send out hard copy newsletters. We send out electronic newsletters. We use the web to get information out. The Elliott project has been almost exclusively web-based so that when people want the extensive information that we have, including a couple of pretty voluminous reports, they're all on our website and people are able to access them. And we've continued to implement energy efficiencies at our buildings, both at headquarters as well as out in the regions. And that includes about $60,000 that were saved down in the South Slough by the use of some wind and solar energy systems. We also are engaged in streamlining our processes. And that, most people think of this in terms of permits and how can we get through the permits through faster. This would save money for the agency as well as for the people who are applying. And so we have a real interest in trying to work out ways to have the process work as smoothly as possible. To that end, we have worked extensively with our federal partners to try and get the federal and state permit process to work more in tandem. Most of the time that works. Usually the ones that you see in the paper don't work. And so there's still some bumps to be worked out, but we are continuing to work on that. We also were involved in a number of work groups over the last couple of years to address some of these issues. And three that I pulled out in particular were our waterway remediation and restoration rules. And these were primarily set up to help with the cleanup for the Portland Harbor, but they'll also help where we have cleanup issues and someone wants to do work for that cleanup in state-owned waterways. We also, I talked a little bit yesterday about our historically filled lands and the issues that are around those lands and how complicated they can be. And so this has been a longstanding source of energy and resource expenditure on both sides, ours and our external folks. And so we worked last year with a pretty broad group and came up with a consensus agreement on how to work forward on that project, on those issues in a much more transparent and, I think, streamlined way. The result is a bill that Senator Johnson has introduced that really would help, hopefully, if it becomes statute, will help us address these issues in a much more timely fashion and with less cost to either the applicant or to ourselves. And then we participated heavily in the Section Dredge Task Force that was a result of legislation last time, and I think is probably going to result in some legislation this time. And all three of those really involved a broad spectrum of individuals, and we tried to work always to come to an agreement as opposed to having a minority and majority opinion. So for this session, I managed to have forgotten my watch, so I have no idea how I'm doing on time. For this session, the major budgetary issues really are around the common school fund distributions. There's always an interest in how much is going to be distributed in terms of the overall education budget. And while it's a small piece, frequently the legislature and the Department of Education think that if they could just have a little bit more, it would help them out. And so we're always watching for questions and issues and requests from the Common School Fund and increasing those distributions, which we have, as I said earlier, set at a level that will hopefully allow us to have a sustaining growth of the fund. We obviously have, as you saw with our option package, have a continuing issue around the Portland Harbor Superfund site and making sure that we fund the legal and technical work to be sure that the state's interests are protected in that work. And then, of course, the Elliott, which we've talked about several times. I want to go back to the agency audits. And this addresses, although not the financial part of it, but the issue that was raised by Representative Rayfield a little bit earlier. If you look in your larger binder, you'll see the 2013 audit, and you'll see the finding that showed that we had some issues with internal controls. We take that very seriously because of the fact that we handle this money that is part of, you know, that is the Common School Fund and is part of the funding for the state schools. And so we wanted to make sure that we address those issues. We hired the limited duration accountant for, and we're able to address them, and we'd like to keep that work going. You can see the result of the work of that accountant for in the audit from 2014, which is in your smaller presentation binder in the appendices. I wanted to end just with a quick overview of the legislative proposals that we have out in the legislative session this time. We have one Senate bill, Senate Bill 249, and this would allow, if you think back to the discussion around the wetland mitigation banks, what we have done in a few places where there were not commercial wetland mitigation banks is to develop those banks from our own funds, from our mitigation fund. And when a commercial bank comes into the area, then we stop selling credits. And that's fine. We don't mind not competing with the private sector, but the result is that the state sometimes has to stop selling credits before they've recuperated their money that they invested in the first place. And we believe it's important to at least allow the state to recoup its money before it stops selling credits. So this Senate bill would allow us to do that. House Bill 2460 would allow us to charge an administrative fee for utility easements across our waterways, our state-owned waterways. This is, I talked about a little bit earlier when we were talking about our aquatic resources management program. 2461 would reinsert some language that we believed was erroneously deleted back in the 2011 session around leasing exemptions. This would cover a lot of very small private individual docks, for instance, that historically have been allowed to be registered, which is a lower cost and lower administrative processing cost for us, way to keep track of these docks. In 2011, in an attempt to include some other exemptions, the language that allowed us to do that was removed. So we're just reinserting that language. House Bill 2462 would allow the department to stop keeping and storing paper copies of other agencies' property transactions. So it's really an attempt to address an older statute that really was more important during the time of hard copy file storage. We would keep the files, but electronically and not in hard copy. House Bill 2463 is our Submerged Land Enhancement Fund. And this is a fund that would allow us, and I believe it was Representative Gomberg who raised this issue yesterday, would allow us to take on some of the responsibility for the hazardous and problematic derelict structures in our waterways, in our state-owned waterways. We wouldn't be increasing fees. We'd just be carving out a portion of the fees to address those issues, which we currently do not do. So we've been a pretty passive landowner, if you will, of our state's waterways, and we'd like to be a little bit more active in that process. So with that, I'm done, and I'll be glad to answer any questions, and I apologize for the rapid fire, just trying to get it through it.
Yeah. Any questions? Excellent. Well, I just want to thank you for putting up with us and your great preparation and getting back to us with the answers that we had yesterday, our questions we had yesterday, so thank you. And so, and I think at this point we'll turn it over to Ms. Pearson from Department of Administrative Services.
Chair Rayfield, members of the subcommittee, my name is Lisa Pearson with the Chief Financial Office, and I'm going to give you a very brief recap of what you've just heard with just the main points. So the first thing are the issues, and as you've heard, there are questions about short-term versus long-term revenue, balancing that, the interests, and also increasing stability. And this is a graph that shows the costs and the return on the forest portion of the Common School Fund through, what was it, about August of 2014, excuse me. So what Director Abrams mentioned for the positive results for 2014 probably aren't reflected in here, but the general trend is certainly on track. And then there's the legacy land use of Portland Harbor, which continues to generate a lot of activity and a lot of costs. And then in terms of investments, there was the agricultural development package and the package to replace and upgrade equipment, the ongoing Portland Harbor legal services, improving the accounting oversight in response to the account or the audit. The position reclassifications for the South SLU National Estuarine Research Reserve, the administrative fee for territorial seabed use applications, and then finally there was an update to the DAS price list, which occurred statewide in every single state agency, but it was an adjustment from the agency request budget. And that is a summary of the budget.
You weren't kidding. That was really short. So are there any other questions from... And Ms. Gilbert, do you have anything else before we adjourn?
Tomorrow we have public testimony for Department of State Lands. That's it.
All right. With that, we'll go ahead and adjourn the meeting. And thank you very
much. Thank you, Chair Rayfield.